So I'd like to start out today maybe with a lighthearted illustration. Maybe you can relate to this. Sort of where Mike ended up today is sort of a good starting point for where I'm going to go a little bit today on the sermon. But I start off with a light illustration. And again, as maybe you can relate to this. And it goes like this. Susie called a friend and asked how she was feeling. "Terrible," came the reply. "My head's splitting, my back and legs are killing me, the house is a mess, and the kids are driving me crazy." Susie, full of compassion, said, "Listen, go lie down. I'll come right over and cook lunch for you, clean up the house, and take care of the children while you get some rest." "And by the way, how is Sam?" "Sam? I have no husband named Sam." "Oh, no," Susie exclaimed. "I must have dialed the wrong number." A pause. "Are you still coming over?" All of us grow weary from time to time in our day-to-day living as parents, grandparents, husbands, wives, employees, or employers. And there's a general term that describes this feeling, you know, when you're just kind of tired. And life is sort of caught up to you, and you're just weary. It's called burnout. And I did look up the term. It's actually a real term. Maybe, I'm sure everybody's heard of burnout. But burnout is a psychological term that refers to long-term exhaustion and diminished interest in work. Research indicates general practitioners have the highest proportion of burnout cases. According to a recent Dutch study, in psychological reports, no less than 40% of these experience high levels of burnout. Psychologists Herbert Freudenberger and Gail North have theorized that the burnout process can be divided into 12 phases, which are not necessarily followed sequentially, nor necessarily in any sense be relevant or exist other than they are an abstract construct. And I thought these were interesting. I think they're short, so I'll read them to you. You might find that you relate to a couple of these, hopefully not all of them. And they say they're not sequential, but I kind of think they're put in sequential. One leads to another. So let me read these to you. There are 12 phases. The first one is the compulsion to prove oneself. And they describe this as, often found at the beginning is excessive ambition. This is one's desire to prove themselves while at the workplace. This desire turns into determination and compulsion. So at first it doesn't sound too bad, but this is where kind of what they're saying the first phase is. Then they go into the second phase, working harder. Because they have to prove themselves to others or try to fit in an organization that does not suit them, people establish high personal expectations. In order to meet these expectations, they tend to focus only on work while they take on more work than they usually would. It may happen that they become obsessed with doing everything themselves. This will show that they are irreplaceable since they are able to do so much work without enlisting the help of others. So that potentially could lead to the third phase, neglecting their needs. Since they have devoted everything to work, they now have no time and energy for anything else. Friends and family, eating and sleeping start to become seen as unnecessary or unimportant as they reduce the time and energy that can be spent on work, which could lead to the fifth phase, displacement of conflicts. Now the person has become aware that what they are doing is not right, but they are unable to see the source of the problem. This could lead to a crisis in themselves and becoming threatening. This is when the first physical symptoms are expressed. Next phase, revision of values. In this stage, people isolate themselves from others. They avoid conflicts and fall into a state of denial towards their basic physical needs while their perceptions change. They also change their value systems. The work consumes all energy they have left, leaving no energy and time for friends and hobbies. Their new value system is their job, and they start to be emotionally blunt. And it keeps going. Next is denial of emerging problems. The person begins to become intolerant. They do not like being social. And if they were to have social contact, it would be merely unbearable for them. Outsiders tend to see more aggression and sarcasm. It's not uncommon for them to blame their increasing problems on time pressure and all the work that they have to do, instead of on the ways that they have changed themselves, which leads potentially to withdrawal. Next phase. Their social contact is now at a minimum, soon turning into isolation. A wall. Alcohol and drugs may be sought out for a release since they are obsessively working by the book. They often have feelings of being without hope or direction, which could lead to oblivious behavior changes. Coworkers, family, and friends, and other people that are in their immediate social circles cannot overlook the behavioral changes of this person, which leads to, and we got four more left here in case you're counting, depersonalization. Losing contact with themselves, it's possible they no longer see themselves as others as vulnerable, as valuable. As well, the person loses track of their personal needs. Their view of life narrows to only seeing in the present time, while their life turns to a series of mechanical functions. The next phase is called inner emptiness. They feel empty inside, and to overcome this, they might look for activity such as overeating, sex, alcohol, or drugs. These activities are often exaggerated, which then leads to some serious, all these are serious, but depression. Burnout may include depression. In that case, the person is exhausted, hopeless, indifferent, and believe that there is nothing for them in the future. To them, there's no meaning to life. Typical depression symptoms arise. And the last one is what they call the burnout syndrome. They collapse physically and emotionally and should seek immediate medical attention. In extreme cases, usually only when depression is involved, suicidal ideas may occur, with it being viewed as an escape for their situation. Only a few actually do this, though. So this is called burnout. This is kind of what someone, put together as the psychological phases of burnout. But what is true in the secular world can also happen to Christians and within the church itself. A dedicated person wakes up tired or burnt out in serving, helping others. They're tired of, or maybe just tired, and helping others, tired of serving seems really, difficult, and they're tired of doing it. He or she may find that the joy of service is gone. Now, the Apostle Paul must have seen something like this in his lifetime when he was in his ministry from time to time. The faithful servants of the church become weary. And that's the term he uses, weary. It may be why Paul was inspired to comment on spiritual burnout in several of his epistles. And I'll just quote these two. We'll refer to them as we go on. In 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 13, he says, "But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in well-doing." In Galatians 6, 9, he says, "And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." In two places, we see that Paul writes specifically about not growing weary in doing good. Now, the Greek word for weary here means to be utterly spiritless, to be wearied out, exhausted. And well doing, as I think it's put in the original King James, means to live virtuously, something that is valuable or virtuous in the way it looks, fair, honest, good, worthy. In other words, he may have seen, and we may have seen people, or maybe felt that way ourselves, people growing weary, it's a tendency to grow weary or tired or getting tired of doing the right things, especially when it comes to helping others and serving. Everyone's well-doing is a little different. If you think about well-doing, how do you define that? Well, maybe your well-doing is maybe you're the person who always sends cards to the sick. People who are sick, you send cards. Maybe you pick up groceries for a widow. Maybe you bring a homemade snack to the food table, I actually have a new one. Maybe you're the person, which I don't know who it is, brings real half and half to the table for coffee, which I appreciated this afternoon. Whoever that is, thank you very much. But maybe that's your well-doing, and hopefully you're not tired of doing it. But everybody has their own well-doing. Maybe yours is setting up the hall for church. Maybe it's taking care of an elderly parent. Maybe your well-doing and doing well is living with an unconverted mate and being faithful and respectful of that person, even though they're not technically converted, and maybe they're a little down on you going to Sabbath every week and they're difficult to deal with, but you're still serving them and respectful and following what the Bible says to how to respond to a mate in the right way. Maybe your well-doing is being respectful to a difficult boss. It could just be praying diligently for years and years for a sick member. Everybody has their own well-doing. Many may be able to relate to feeling weary and doing well. With the initial enthusiasm that we often have when we come into God's church, we're willing to serve and do whatever is asked for us. We do it wholeheartedly and we're enthusiastic. And there was genuine joy. We can think, I really enjoyed those times. Everybody jumped in and served, and we're helping and serving. But as years go by, maybe decades, maybe some of that joy has faded. It might have even faded to the point you might describe yourself as being weary of well-doing. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, maybe burnout, maybe not to the extreme levels as was described in the psychological phases, but maybe you feel a little burnt out. Maybe you are someone who feels weary when it comes to doing good, or as the King James says, well-doing. Today, let's look at some of the causes of growing weary. And after we do that, look at some strategies, some thoughts for getting us back the enthusiasm and the joy of doing good and well-doing. So first, let's look at why we may grow weary. What are some of the reasons we could grow weary? We have a few here. I have a few here. You may have your own thoughts on this, and so this is not the exhaustive list. But here's some thoughts. And the first one is there is no observable results, or at least it appears that way. We grow weary because whatever we're doing, there seems to be no results in how we're doing it. Now, we are in a results-oriented society. When you play golf and you get a good score, you keep the scorecard and you track the score. When you fish, you produce a stringer of fish and take a picture of it as proof. The whole business world is based on measurable results. You have stock price and earnings and many, many other ratios and things that people look at that really show what are the results of doing something. In our jobs, we get measured in some way based on our results. We're always being measured on our results. And maybe completing a project on time or in budget. Maybe it's the number of deliveries you do on time. Maybe how many calls you answered in three rings or less if you're on a call center. Or how many calls you resolved, was it in 2 minutes or less? There are always these sort of type of things that are being measured. Teachers are being measured on the scores of their students. Schools get funding based on the results. If they're not funded, if they're not doing well, they don't get funded. In fact, these are all metrics that are being recorded. And the results all have consequences. And so if you do the right things, you should have results. Today, everything is measured to show progress. Now, yesterday, I think it was actually on Thursday, I heard a little snippet of news that says that many of the states, I don't remember how many in the U.S., have improved in lowering the obesity level in children, except Illinois. Illinois is one of the ones that did not move at all in that ranking. But even obesity rates in children are being measured to see if progress is being made. And somewhat of a serious thing because it does cause health problems. But even that's being measured, and what states are going up and down. And schools are obviously trying to help with that by what they put in the food, what they serve, and what's in the available to get in lunchrooms. So all these things are being measured. Who's going up, who's going down, who's got the best results. And many activities we can measure the success in tangible ways, many I just mentioned. However, doing good doing good or doing well-doing does not always have an immediate result or is measurable. Many may serve for years without knowing the results of their work. We may grow weary thinking that non-visible results means no results. I'm doing these things and I see no results. And that, you know, that can be a little weary. So, well, let's look at an example. I think you'll be interested in seeing this example of somebody in the Old Testament who actually was told, you're going to have no results. You don't work hard with no results. Let's turn to Isaiah 6. Isaiah 6. And it's sort of a, you may have read this, or it's been a while since you've read it. And it's sort of an interesting dialogue here. Isaiah 6, and we'll start in verse 5. And this is Isaiah speaking in verse 5, starting out in this dialogue. And it says in verse 5, Isaiah 6, it says, "Woe to me, I cried. I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among the people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Then one of the seraphim flew, this was an angel, to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." Verse 8, "Then I heard a voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send and who shall go for us?' And I said, 'Here I am, send me.'" So that's sort of a noble response. Verse 9 says, "He said, 'Go and tell these people, this people, be ever hearing, but never understanding, be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused, make their eyes dull, and close their eyes. Otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed.' Then I said, 'For how long, Lord?'" So he's kind of saying, "How long do I have to do this sort of process?" And he answered, "Until the cities lie in ruin and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields ruined and ravaged, until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though a tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. But as the terebinth and the oak leaf stumps, when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land." So imagine being Isaiah, called to do a job in which God says the people aren't going to respond, and to the point that, you know, you're going to keep doing this until finally they're removed and all the cities are ruined and desolate. I'm sure at moments during Isaiah's life, he was hoping just for a result, something through his efforts, even a small one. Imagine during the 16 years of Ahaz. You know, Ahaz was one of the worst kings ever. In fact, he was so wicked, he wasn't even allowed to be buried with the other kings. They said, "You're so bad, you're being buried in another place." But for 16 years, he ruled Judah in Jerusalem. And imagine being Isaiah, and every time you knew you'd go up there to warn Jerusalem, and probably the king specifically, you know, that there would be no results. Ahaz is not going to listen. He's a bad guy. And for 16 years, you do it with no results. If you can put yourselves in Isaiah's shoes, do you think at some point he might have grown weary knowing that Ahaz would not listen? No, at least Moses had a response eventually, a result, right? Moses went up to the Pharaoh, and at least the 10th time he went up there, he had a result, and we know the story on that. But Isaiah, what it appear, had no results in this situation. And based on Scripture, from what we know, he had very little positive results with King Ahaz and through most of his prophesying to the other kings as well. He lived through many people's, you know, the good news, he lived at the end where Hezekiah was there, and Hezekiah wasn't too bad of a king. So maybe he saw some things there. But the end, the result of his whole thing was that Israel was, or Judah was taken captive. But sometimes doing good and living up to our calling, and Isaiah had a calling, we have a calling, there may be times when we see no results, or at least we don't see the results right now. You know, the words of Isaiah, if you think about them, and the prophecies that he had in there, especially about the birth of Jesus, gives each one of us faith in the wonderful future, the prophecies of also of Christ's second return, when he will establish his government. You know, that's by itself very, there's results in what he recorded and what he said. You know, we all know the scriptures. Let me just read this to you. This is one of his scriptures we know well. In Isaiah 9, 6, verse 7, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice, from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Now, his recorded words give us hope of a future time, an insight into a time when Christ will return. So in Isaiah's example, he may not have seen the results, but his work and his prophecies give us hope, don't they? We see that he prophesied there'd be a child given, and we know that was Jesus Christ. It was prophesied long before. And ultimately, there's going to be a second coming. Even to those who really have very limited understanding of the scriptures derive hope of a better time in the future when they sing, when millions and millions every year sing Handel's Messiah. Isaiah labored for God with no obvious results from a worldly point of view. The nation of Judah did not return back to God in his lifetime. The nation went into captivity. Not a real results-oriented outcome that he could see. If we focus on immediate results as our motivation, you know, we will become weary. We're looking for something right now to happen based on our results. You know, it comes a little wearisome. Thankfully, the prophets like Isaiah continued in their calling and their well-doing, even without seeing very many tangible results in their lifetime. So that's one of the things that I think we should think about, why we get a little wearisome. Maybe we don't see results. And we just have to remind ourselves, maybe results are further down the line, or we can't always see the results that God's doing in someone's life based on our doing well. Another reason is we may get wearisome is maybe we perceive in others a lack of enthusiasm for serving, which can cause us to become weary and discouraged. Maybe like, why isn't that person doing more? Why aren't they serving more? And maybe we get a little discouraged ourselves. You know, in some situations, we have heard it stated 90% of the work is done by 10% of the people. Maybe that's your workplace. The other 10% of the work is done by the remaining 90% of the people. It is any, you know, it's no doubt that 10% get discouraged. If that's, you know, that's sort of a thought, and if they become weary. If you're the 10% thinking you're doing all the work, and you see other 90% not doing very much, you know, maybe we feel like this person who's talking to a coworker. Now, these numbers are a little out of date, but it kind of illustrates an interesting, humorous thought. It says, "Are you tired? Are you tired? The population of this country is 280 million. So it's a little outdated because I think we're above 300 now. But, you know, when this was written, it says the country was 280 million. 124 million are over the age of 65, leaving 156 million to do the work. There are 104 million people under the age of 25, leaving 52 million to do the work. There are 30 million people who work for the federal government, which leaves 22 million to do the work. 4 million are in the armed forces, which leaves 18 million to do the work. Deduct 17,800,000 who work in state, county, or city offices, leaving 200,000 to do the work. There are 188,000 in hospitals and institutions of various kinds, leaving 12,000 to do work. Now, it may be of interest to you to know that there are 11,998 people in jail. So that leaves just two people to carry the load, and that's you and me. And I'm getting tired of doing everything myself. So maybe that's how you feel sometimes, a little exaggerated, but maybe it seems like you're doing a lot of things and others aren't. Well, let's turn to Matthew 20. There's a lesson here, Matthew 20. In verse 1, or read? Matthew 20, verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. And I figured this was for my purposes, 6 a.m., as we'll see, we'll come back a little later on. So 6 a.m., he agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About 9 in the morning, he went out and saw others. So he's out at 9 o'clock, and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. So they were doing nothing. He told them, you also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right. So they went. He went out again about noon and about 3 in the afternoon and did the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, why have you been standing here all day long doing nothing? So they're doing nothing. Because no one has hired us, they said. He said to them, you also go and work in the vineyard. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired, going on to the first. The workers who were hired about 5 in the afternoon came and each received a denarius. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. These who were hired last worked only 1 hour. And we know they were doing nothing up until then. Maybe that wasn't their own fault, but they were doing nothing, they said. They only worked 1 hour. And you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day. But he answered one of them, I am not being unfair to you, friend. Didn't you agree to work for 1 denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous? So last will be first, and the first will be last. So there's a lot of lessons there. But the part I want to focus on is, in part, those who had maybe worked 12 hours were a little upset that for 11 hours of the day, the other workers did nothing. This could be a little discouraging. You know, if you can imagine. However, the instruction should be clear to us. You know, each one of us has our own calling, and we're each one of us is individually responsible to the owner of the vineyard, God. You know, we have our calling. We have things that we are called to do. We have our own gifts. We have things how we serve, and other people have their calling, and they have their gifts, and they have when they're called, not only when they're called, but how they're serving. And it's really up to God, them and God, if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. We have our own calling. We worry about ourselves. But it may be discouraging to see others, just like the people in the parable. Well, they did nothing for 11 hours, and it's a little discouraging if you're working hard for 12 and others are not working. So that could be why we get all weary. We feel like we're doing it all while others maybe are doing less. Let's look at another reason why we may become weary. Lack of appreciation can cause us to become weary. Lack of appreciation can cause us to become weary. Now, when I was in college back in the late 80s, there was my senior year. You had to wait till your senior. I think you could take your junior, but there was a class that everybody loved. It was like the class that was like all-time favorite, I think, during that time period. It was called Christian Leadership. And it was supposed to be a class for giving people principles of how to go back in the church area and help out in some way. And it was an extremely useful class because it was taught by a man named Karen Catherwood. Some of you may remember the name. But he had a wonderful gift of weaving stories into his points. He could just, you know, tell, you know, a 50-minute class would go by in 10 minutes. He would tell a story. It wasn't just stories, but he had points. He had a point and a story to complement his point. And he had served in Italy in different areas and seen a lot of different interesting things. So he had a lot of stories to tell about things that worked and things that didn't work so well. And he had real-life illustrations of those who became discouraged within a church area because they didn't get appreciated for what they did. You know, and he was trying to make the point that if you go back in your church area and if you happen to become a leader in your church of some sort, you know, show words of appreciation. It goes a long way. You know, there's people that serve and serve. And he had a story in which I don't remember the details of people who had served very, very hard in a certain situation. And, you know, one of the leaders of the church that time came by and just was very unaware of all the work that had gone into some serving. And his point was, you know, make sure you acknowledge and appreciate what people do. It goes a long way, because if you don't do it, if you don't appreciate what others do, you know, you can become discouraged. It reminds me, actually, of a story similar to the story of the example of the lepers who were healed. Turn to Luke 17 with me. And you get the sense in this that maybe Christ was a little discouraged here. It doesn't say explicitly, but you kind of get a sense he just at least had a head-scratching moment, like, oh, that's interesting. Luke 17, verse 11. Now, most of you probably know that, you know, leprosy was the worst thing you could get. It is today. It's one of the worst things you can get. And it just would make your life, it would change your life forever. You're put away from everybody, public life, and you had a pretty much miserable life if you happened to get leprosy. So it was a very, very, very bad thing to have happen to you if you were a leper. So Luke 17, verse 11. Now it happened as he went to Jerusalem that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Then as he entered a certain village, there met him 10 men who were lepers who stood afar off. Again, that makes sense because lepers were not allowed to mix. He didn't want to be around a leper. So they were probably a distance off. And they lifted up their voices. They tried to yell really loud to get the attention of Jesus. And they said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. So when he saw them, he said to them, go show yourselves to the priest. And so it was that they went and they were cleansed. And one of them, when they saw that he was healed, returned and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face and his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. We heard about that in the sermonette. So it implies that the others were Jews, potentially. And here's the Samaritan. You know, so verse 17. So Jesus answered and said, were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? Were there not any found who returned to give glory to God except this foreigner? So he was viewing him as a Samaritan, a foreigner, not even somebody who really understood God's way. That's the way he was kind of portrayed. And he said to them, arise, go your way, your faith has made you well. So here we see a glimpse that maybe Jesus, just for a moment there, might have been a bit discouraged that out of the 10 lepers, only one came back. And then again, this is a life-changing event. I mean, your life would have been totally changed if you had leprosy and were healed. And only one came back to give him thanks, and it was a Samaritan, not even someone who was of Jewish background. Only one showed appreciation for what he had done. Lack of appreciation, and maybe you've, you know, in your own way, have helped somebody, have done things, and you never really got the appreciation or the thanks. And that can really drain us of our enthusiasm for doing well doing. It is discouraging if we do something, we just never hear a thanks back. So it is something that can cause us to be weary as well, one of the reasons. So those are some of the reasons maybe may become weary in well-doing. You may have your own thoughts on that, your own points, but those are the three that I kind of put in here, why we may become weary, and maybe you can relate to some of those. Let's now look at how we can avoid becoming weary in well-doing. How do we become not weary? How do we keep doing the right thing, well-doing, doing what's we're called to do in service and helping others? First, now I started off with sort of a very basic point, but I think it's something for us to consider. We kind of get into more deeper points later on, or maybe more instructional. But it's a very straightforward point of how we can maybe avoid becoming weary in well-doing. If you are weary in doing well, maybe make a change. Make a change. Now, what I mean by that, I've known people who have served in the same area for decades. Decades. I believe one person told me he did sound for 20 years. 20 years doing sound. And after 20 years, I sensed the person was a little bit weary of coming to church early. You get to come way early for church, you know, earlier than everybody else every week. You have to set up the cables. You have to put the speakers up. You have to put the microphones in. You have to do testing. And then when you're doing sound, you're frequently told by people in the congregation, it's too loud, it's too soft, you know, and you never can quite make it right for people. And you get, you know, so you get critiques of the sound. No, I think we've kind of not done that. I think we've kind of at one point said, if you have a problem with sound, come tell one person, and that person will kind of do it. But I can tell you, pretty much the sound person knows there's a problem. So telling them there's a sound problem is most likely not being helpful. They're struggling to get it just right. Then the sound person, you know, has to take 45 minutes after church to take the sound down, system down, and then there's limited fellowship to access, you know, to talk to people, to go to the food table, you know, and there's not, like I said, always a lot of appreciation for sound people. So this person, I could sense, was weary of doing sound. So the good thing is that, and this is going way, way back, so it's not in recent history, but the good thing is, but we see the fruit of this, we got other people trained in sound. And actually, the person who was doing sound for 20 years stopped doing sound. And that person was able to do something else. And I believe that when I've been ushering or helping on the food table, something that he always probably wished I could do. I wish I could really be an usher, but I'm stuck on sound. So he had other things he moved on to, which is fine. So the point is, maybe you can make a change and into serving another way. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, maybe due to circumstances, we just can't make a change. You know, taking care of an elderly parent or family member isn't something we can just say, okay, I'm opting out of this today and then I'll do this. You know, there's things we can't change out of. But there is sometimes opportunities to say, I'm really done this for a long time. I wouldn't mind serving in another area or doing something different for a change of pace. That's something, an option we should consider. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a starting point. Let's look at some other, so that's point number one of how we can avoid not being weary. Number two, do good with the right motivation. Have the right motivation. Now, how often do we do something good for others and we don't do it for the right motivation? You know, many times the act of good, doing something good, is like giving to a charity fund. It's done with favors that may come later, or doors to open up, or recognition in some way. People give for recognition and praise. And I always take notice when you look at who is given to causes, and there's always sometimes, you know, a large donation attributed to anonymous. Sometimes, but most times it's only a few of those are in there. You know, you see these things like, you know, part of the super triple diamond platinum club who's given, you know, $5 million or more, you know, and you see all these names in there and who's given the highest amount. And it's usually a very short list because most people can't give $5 million or $10 million or whatever that highest level is. And, you know, if you're like me, you're like, you see the names and maybe you recognize some of the names from, you know, a business person or maybe a corporation, and you're kind of impressed. Wow, they gave $5 million. And it probably did the job, what they wanted. My opinion of that person just went up, or that organization. Maybe it's an oil company, or maybe it's, like, you know, that oil company's not so bad after all. You know, they spilled some oil, but they gave $5 million to charity. You know, that's a lot of times why people give, you know. That it did the job, you know, that it did what they intended to do. My thoughts of them have gone up, and a lot of times it's a PR move. Sometimes it's to gain favor with others to access decision makers. You know, if you're the sponsor of this fund and you get $5 million and that person who sponsors the fund just happens to be, you know, a very important person and you give enough money, you know, you might get invited to lunch with that person and then you could, you know, have some influence on maybe something you want. You know, that's kind of what's done many times. Then there's a very, very short list of anonymous. You know, every once in a while, anonymous. You always wonder who is that anonymous person? You know, and I always think, you know, if I had $5 million, let's say we had that much money to give, would I actually say anonymous? Would I want someone to know, hey, I gave $5 million? It's an interesting thing to think about, but I'm always impressed by those who choose, for whatever reason, to just put anonymous there. They don't want anybody to know that they gave. Let's turn to Matthew 6. Matthew 6. Something for us to think about. Matthew 6 and verse 1 says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men. Now, let me just say, if you want to put your name, if you give so much money and you want to be under the, you know, $10 list of names, they have it out here. You know, if you go out in the hallway, there's a list of people that have given certain amounts of money to the Hinsdale Community Center. And you see who's given money, individuals and corporations. I didn't really see anonymous, but you see a lot of names, right? And maybe it's okay to do that because it's, you know, not necessarily wrong, but this is what the Bible says. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. You know, because really the reward that you got is recognition. Oh, they're a nice person. They gave money. They must be, you know, good people. Verse 2, therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, that they have the reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. When we do good for the right reasons, we do it for some intrinsic good in helping someone else out, not for some, you know, return favor, not for recognition. You know, what's really the problem with giving, the problem with doing good for praise of men? You know, you'd say, well, you know, what's really wrong with that? What's the end result? Well, eventually, to receive praise, to keep receiving praise, we need to keep increasing the level, don't we, to impress others. That's kind of the trap you fall into. You know, what we did yesterday, everybody thought, wow, they did that. That's so impressive. Well, you know, tomorrow, next day is sort of ho-hum. Oh, well, they did it again. You know, you have to keep raising the bar. And at some point, that gets really tiring, doesn't it? Keep trying to outdo your giving or serving or whatever than you did the day before. You know, the person who gave $5 million can only do that so many times. I mean, even Bill Gates will eventually run out of money if he gives billions and billions. And at some point, he can't outdo the last thing. He's eventually going to run out. And not that anything's wrong with what he's doing, but I'm saying it can't be the reason why you're doing something, because at some point, you're going to get tired of trying to raise the level for recognition. When we do the right things for the right reason and motivation, we're not compelled to keep raising the bar because we're not doing it to impress anyone. We're just doing it for the right reasons. We're not trying to have anybody see what we did and say, oh, what a nice job you did. You're not trying to impress anyone. So you do it for the right reasons. Simply, we are doing it because we're serving without any expectation of anything in return. There's a lot less chance of disappointment or weariness in this approach. We're not expecting anything in return. You don't have disappointment and you don't grow weary as quickly in doing it that way. So let's do things, you know, we should do things for the right reasons, to serve God, to serve others, not for the glory of men. All right, let's go to point number 3. How do we avoid becoming weary? When we are weary, and it does happen sometimes, when we're weary, you know, we're physical, ask God for strength. Ask God for strength. At some point, most of us have realized a sense of weariness, maybe a little bit of burnout in doing good, because we may be relying on our own strength. In our younger years, it may seem like we can do everything with our own strength. And as we pass into our 30s, we see small cracks, but we still feel pretty confident in our abilities. You know, for the most part, you know, we can keep relying on our strength. But the 40s, you know, we start to see clearly, especially as you get up to the upper 40s, that we're not 20 anymore. There are not any more delusions that we're 20. No, the delusions, hey, I can still do what I can do at 20, is kind of over. The all-nighters, get up, go do whatever I need to do, those days are kind of over, and you realize it pretty in the 40s. You try it once or twice, and you realize, wow, I'm not 20 anymore. You know, things are not that easy. Muscles hurt, your stamina wanes, things get tougher. Now, I can't speak about the 50s yet. I'll let somebody else do that, or the 60s. But I have noticed that as the age group goes up, that group relies more on God. You can just tell they rely more on God for their strength and getting through things and doing things. Reliance on God's strength and not our own is often learned. It's how we, as we grow older, we learn, as you grow older, relying on God is where we get our strength. Let's turn to Philippians 4:10. Philippians 4:10. Here's Paul, and this section is often used to kind of show contentment, being content. But I want to point out one part of the scripture here. Philippians 4, verse 10, it says, "But I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard of need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to be abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need." Verse 13, "I can do all things through Jesus who strengthens me." At this point, you know, I did some calculations, and Paul's probably in his 50s. He isn't a young man anymore, relying on his own strength. Paul has no delusion on where his strength is coming from to keep going in his ministry. Paul had an infirmity that was causing him hardships in his travels and ministry. Paul knew that to continue, it would be only with God's power and strength. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 19. And it makes another interesting point here. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7. And here's Paul talking, speaking. He says, "Unless I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you. For my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, and in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, I am strong.'" Now, Paul relied on God for his strength to move forward. Paul refers to his strength to keep going as the power of Christ that rested upon him. If we are weary, in which we may be, in well-doing, maybe we should pause just for a moment and consider asking God for strength to keep going in our well-doing. Paul did it, and we can do it as well. All right, let's go to the next point of how to avoid being weary. Take time to charge up your spiritual batteries. Take time to charge up your spiritual batteries. Now, if we're weary and just so busy, it may be simply we just need to take a time out and charge up our spiritual batteries. I didn't mean check out. I said just time out. Not walk away, a time out, and charge up your spiritual batteries. It is possible that with all the responsibilities that are thrust on us, that come our way, we grow weary, and our spiritual tank is just empty. And it would appear from Scripture that even Jesus, when he was here on earth, needed time to recharge his spiritual batteries. Let's look at this. Let's look at Matthew 14. Maybe something here you haven't noticed before. It's about the feeding of the 5,000. Matthew 14, and we'll start in verse 13. And it's something, an interesting, sort of interesting points made here about Jesus. Verse 13, "When Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to deserted place by himself." He wanted to go be by himself for a little while. But when the multitude heard it, so he tried to be by himself, but at this point, he couldn't get away. People saw him. They followed him on foot. So he appears to be in the boat. They see where he's going. They're following him around the Sea of Galilee. Now, I've been there, so you can kind of, it's pretty big body of water, but if someone's in a boat, you know, they can only go so far. You can kind of see, okay, they're going over there, and you track him around. The people are following him around, and we don't see where he lands. And when he lands, we'll engage him again. So that's what's going on. They followed him on foot from the cities. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude, and he was moved with compassion for them. So he probably like, oh, I just want to be able to have some time to myself, to have some prayer. And he sees this, what's going on here, and he was compassionate for them. And he healed their sick. When it was evening, his disciples came to him saying, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is already late. Send the multitudes away that they may go into the village and buy themselves some foods." So this is what the disciples were saying. But Jesus said to them, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "We have only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He said, bring them here to me. Then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass. So he's sort of taking over the situation here, organizing things. And he took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples, and the disciples gave to the multitudes. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets of the fragments that remained. Now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. So it implies there was much more than 5,000. So there's 5,000 men. Maybe there was, we don't know how many women and children were there, but we know at least 5,000 men and probably lots of women and children. So it could be up to 10,000. So immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitude away. So they were fed. He did instruct them to kind of depart. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on a mountain with disciples. No, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now, when evening came, he was there alone. He was alone there. It looks like, from this account, that Jesus needed to, as it says, be by himself. His first attempt was kind of halted when a multitude of at least 5,000 were following him. And Jesus, had to change his plans, didn't he? He goes, well, this was his plan, and he changed him on the fly. He was flexible in that way. Sometimes that's life, isn't it? Sometimes something comes up. The kids wake up early, wake up in the middle of the night sick. Our spouses need help with something. A member needs help. Or, our best laid plans to study and pray and meditate are put on hold. But notice that Jesus, even though he kind of had to take care of the situation, that he did go back to the mountain and be by himself and pray and meditated. He was alone to do that. And what was Jesus doing? Well, he was filling up his spiritual tank. He was, communing with God, the Father, and filling up his spiritual tank. Jesus was physical. He was a human. He could get tired. And he had to, try dealing with 5,000 men and this plus women and trying feeding them, and healing the sick, it says. That's a lot of interaction. He was probably tired. And he needed to fill up his tank. He needed to recharge his batteries, you might say. And otherwise, there was a risk of becoming weary in everything he had to do. He did have to heal the sick. He did teach. He had to teach the disciples. He had to get the disciples all ready for what was coming. So he had to spend time with them. He confronted the Pharisees. He knew he had to prepare for the Passover that was coming up, the last Passover. He knew he had at times he had to feed the multitudes. He had a lot going on. And he had to take time to charge up his spiritual tank. So maybe that's what we need to do. If we're just weary, maybe we just need to stop and plan some time to charge up our spiritual batteries, to be by ourselves, to study, to pray, to meditate, and fast. If we see and that's a way to avoid being weary. We charge up our batteries, we can get energized and get back out there and help people out. All right, another point in avoiding being weary and doing well, focus on the long term, not the short term. Focus on the long term, not the short term. We grow weary if we focus on the physical, in the perspective of eternity, is a very short time. You know, however long we live is a short time compared to eternity. And we might live 70 years, 80 years, 90 years. That's a short time in the overall scheme of eternity. If we focus on the spiritual outcomes of doing good, we should be focusing on the long-term vision of where we're going. Let's turn to Galatians 6. Galatians 6, we get the idea of what we're doing when we do good in this lifetime, what we're really trying to do, what we're trying to achieve or sow. It says here in verse 7, Galatians 6, verse 7, it says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption." To go kind of like the sermon, if you're in the world doing worldly things, eventually you don't have the results of that. But if you're in the world doing sowing to the Spirit and thinking of the long term of what you're supposed to be doing and what God's calling you to, here's what happens. "But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good. For in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." Losing heart is not growing weary. Stay strong. Now, this is a fundamental law of nature. What we sow is what we reap. Beans, corns, you know, weeds, whatever it is, we sow what we reap. We plant beans, we get beans. We do things that aren't good, we get weeds. Paul is saying here that if we do not grow weary but continue to sow good work, we will reap eternal life. That's the vision God has for us. Keeping this vision of what God's calling us to helps us to grow, sow spiritual fruit, which leads to eternal life. Even if we don't see the outcomes today, we're doing good. God sees it, and it's sowing to eternal outcomes. When we do good, we're sowing spiritual fruit. Sometimes we see the results in our lifetime. Sometimes we don't. And if we don't, though, we still know that we're sowing seeds for eternal life. That's the long-term vision, the long-term view, not the short-term. The feast days, which are just around the corner, is a wonderful time that we look forward to. It reminds us of a wonderful time going forward. It reminds us of the results and the outcomes of when all will be falling God's way. We're sowing those seeds today to participate in that wonderful future that's coming, that the Feast of Tabernacles pictures, you know, future time where all of the people are living the right way. And what we're doing today in this lifetime, in our world, allows us to participate in that wonderful future that the feast pictures. We look forward to that. And it's just a few weeks away, so that's exciting. Only a few weeks of trumpets. Hard to believe. All right, so we've got to look into the long term, not the short term, when we do things that are good. You know, we're not sowing for the current time period, we're sowing seeds for the future. Let's look also, another way we can also avoid growing weary is to look to Jesus as the example of endurance. Look to Jesus as the example of endurance. When you run a long distance race, you know, there's always going to be a moment. Doesn't matter how many times you practice, how long you practice for running the marathon or whatever it may be, any long distance, there's always going to be a point in time when your body says, "Now I feel kind of weary and I want to stop." And hopefully we don't. We push on, we keep going. We want to finish the race even if our body is tired. Often those who are ahead of us sometimes, if you run a marathon, those who have finished the race already can be inspiring to runners who are still going and their weariness. You know, they come back and encourage people, keep going, you know. And maybe they pass somebody and they say, keep going. You know, and that can be inspirational by itself. We have the best example of someone who endured and has already finished the race, who does inspire us, who does encourage us to keep going in our weariness, to keep enduring. Let's turn to Hebrews 12. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Hebrews 12, verse 1. It says, "Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." And each one of us has a path we're on. And it says, "Looking to Jesus, the founder," as we're running this race, we look to Jesus, "the founder, the perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, he knew what was ahead of him. He knew what he was doing. He knew why he was doing it. He understood the vision. He understood the plan. He understood what was ahead of him. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Then it says, consider him who endured. And when you say consider him, it means you think about it. You're like, well, you know, let's think about what Christ did. Let's think about his example. Let's focus on Jesus. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. So we think about, you know, and we consider and we focus on Jesus, who endured. And he didn't grow weary. He kept on going. He knew what was ahead of him. And it says that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. He's the example that we follow. He's the person who's finished the race. And he will encourage us to keep going. In our calling from God, we will encounter hardships and hostility. But we reflect on the example of Jesus, who endured and persevered. We run the race set before us, knowing that we do not grow weary or faint-hearted, that we, like Jesus, will receive the joy that is set before us. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4. It says, starting in verse 16, so we do not lose heart. It also means we don't grow weary. So we do not lose heart, though our outer nature is wasting away. Now we're getting older. Things are getting tougher. As you get older, everything's not easy again. But our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an internal weight of glory beyond all comparison. If we grow weary, if you find yourself in that state right now, let's focus on the example of Jesus Christ, who endured for the joy that was in front of him. Now is the time not to lose heart or grow weary. We should keep going and renewing our inner self, our inner, day by day, our inner nature being renewed. Even if our physical body is growing weary, we renew ourselves inner self through the power of Jesus Christ and God. So, brethren, the Bible recognizes that God's people sometimes gets weary. We live in a physical world, we serve, but we can grow weary. If you feel weary right now, I hope you take some time to recharge your batteries. Look into the future of what God has called us to. That by itself motivates us to keep going. Ask God for his strength and encouragement to keep doing good, not growing weary in a hostile world. As we leave here today and we start thinking about the holy days are coming up, let's be encouraged, inspired by Paul's instructions that we found in Galatians 6, verse 9. And it says, and I'll read this to you, let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith.